Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff, and discuss the nomination of Senator John Kerry to be the next Secretary of State, which will apparently sail through the Senate. Meanwhile, the expected nomination of Senator Chuck Hagel to be the next Secretary of Defense is under intense fire from the AIPAC lobby and neoconservatives, who are desperately trying to torpedo Hagel's chance of heading up the Pentagon. Then we'll continue the conversation and speak with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. We will look into the evolution of Lieutenant John Kerry, who testified against the Vietnam War that he fought in before the very same Senate Foreign Relations Committee he later came to head. We'll also discuss the explosive story the press are ignoring, the bombshell tape Bob Woodward uncovered that ended up in the style section of the Washington Post, revealing how Fox News tried to run General Petraeus for president. Then finally, we'll speak with Altanet's Washington Bureau Chief, Adele Stan, who attended the NRA's press conference where they proposed posting armed guards at every school in America. We will discuss why the gun lobby that has only 4.3 million members is able to wield so much power on Capitol Hill, and her article at Altanet.org, NRA's bizarre press conference, More Guns Now. And joining me now is Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And as I mentioned in the opening, Colonel Wilkerson, Kerry's looks like he'll sail through the Senate and become the next Secretary of State. Conversely, the expected nomination of Chuck Hagel seems to be under intense fire. Where do you understand the fire is coming from? Who are the people that are trying to scuttle Chuck Hagel's nomination before it's even begun?
Ian, let me say first that I've known Senator Hagel either indirectly through Colin Powell and his close friendship with the senator, or lately myself directly for about 20 years, and there is no more decent man and more balanced foreign and security policy observer that I've known in my life. This is a man who cares about the national interest of his country, cares about the people, and expresses himself with some courage on both of those counts. And I think that's where the opposition is coming from. People in this country, on the extremes, do not like the truth. I think it was George Orwell who once said, in a society of lies, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. Well, we live in a society of lies. And the liars who are coming after Chuck are predominantly amongst the crowd that is so fascinated with the state of Israel that it would sacrifice every interest America has on behalf of that state. Those are some of the people, because Chuck has taken a very balanced attitude. He knows the Palestinians exist. And he knows that their claim to the land that Israel claims in the West Bank and Gaza is just as strong as Israel's. And he knows that their plight is dire. And he knows that part of the reason for that is Israeli policy, particularly in the last few years under Bibi Netanyahu. So Chuck Hagel is apt to tell the truth about that, and people don't like that, especially Abe Foxman at the ADL or the Anti-Defamation League and other places like that, who strike and strike and strike and have no egalitarian bone in their body, have no bone for truth in their body. If it's against Israel, it is against the world, is their motto. So that's one place. Another place is he's made some very balanced statements, not unlike those of Secretary Gates when he was Secretary of Defense, and afterwards too, about Iran and about the folly, the utter folly of starting another war in Western Asia. He's made some very strong statements in that regard. And there's some other people too out there who are coming from different interest groups and so forth. But I think those are the two primary ones that you can call them neoconservatives, if you will, who really don't like Chuck because he tells the truth and he has a very balanced attitude about foreign and security policy.
But so when neoconservatives like Bill Kristol come out against Chuck Hagel, are they because he's so much a spear carrier for the neoconservatives, Kristol, his magazine Commentary, which was started by the very founder of neoconservatism, the impression I get is that the neoconservatives and the pro-Israel lobby have always had a lot of traction in the Department of Defense. They've had assistant secretaries at all level in the George W. Bush administration. I think every assistant secretary was a neoconservative, chief among them, of course, being Paul Wolfowitz, the architect in many ways of the Iraq War. The State Department is independent. The CIA is quite independent, but that's been where on the National Security Council, it's always been. It seems like a tradition that whoever's heads up the Middle East desk at the National Security Council under whoever administration it is, they're going to be very, very pro-Israel and approved by AIPAC. So is that the way it works in Washington? So in other words, the fact that somebody that's not already in the bag for AIPAC, like Chuck Hagel, they're going to fight him tooth and nail?
I think that's fairly true. Now let me point out quickly, I've done some work of late, last 2 years or so, for the J Street Group, Jeremy Ben-Ami's group, which has been set up, at least in part, to sort of counteract the right-wing extremism of AIPAC. So there are many, many people in America, many of them Jewish Americans, who don't look at AIPAC as being the real voice for Israel. And that's increasingly true as Jeremy and J Street gain more and more influence. For example, in the recent elections, I think they backed 71 different candidates, and 70 of them won their office. AIPAC can't boast anything even close to that. So J Street, with a more balanced attitude to the Israeli-Palestinian situation, and frankly, the reason I'm with them, a more realistic attitude about Israel's long-term security, not short-term security, long-term security. They're taking ground every day, every hour from AIPAC. So it's not as powerful as it was, but back to your statement, yes, it is still powerful. We still put, for example, people like Dennis Ross, whether we're Republicans or Democrats, we put people like Dennis Ross, who's nothing more than Israel's lawyer, proved it at Camp David 2 and Taba, essentially helping Barack sabotage those talks. We still put them in very influential positions. Elliot Abrams, a convicted felon, comes back into the government. Douglas Feith, just short of being a convicted felon, comes back into government and has influence. So, yes, these people are very well organized. They're ruthless. They have a vision, and they carry out that vision whenever they can. They have people in and out of government who are with them. But I think their days are numbered, at least I hope they are, because things are turning against them rather massively. And they have been doing that since the utter folly of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So I'm hoping they're losing influence, and I'm hoping that if Chuck Hagel is nominated, the president and he both will stick it out, because I know he can be confirmed.
And Colonel Wilkerson, also in coming to Chuck Hagel's defense, apart from the J Street liberal pro-Israel lobby.
Well, they're not. I wouldn't call them liberal. I would call 65% of Jewish Americans liberal by their voting record, both domestic and international. But I wouldn't call J Street liberal. They're still very much conservative in the sense they're for Israel security. It's just they have an entirely different view, and I think more accurate view, of how that security is ensured than the neocons do.
Sure. Well, I was going to say, though, that an Israeli-born, Omaha-based rabbi who's known Chuck Hagel for many years said that the charges that against the former Nebraska senator and potential nominee for Secretary of Defense, that he's somehow anti-Israel or anti-Semitic, are extremely stupid. Quoting R.A. Azriel, the rabbi at the Temple Israel in Omaha, Nebraska. I thought we were done with this, he said. You know, I thought we were done already with this childishness of being Jewish, where everyone who says something critical about Israel needs to be labeled as anti-Semitic. I find this extremely stupid and definitely not helpful.
I read his remarks, and I agree with him 100%. I would just I would argue with the semantics there just slightly. I don't think anyone, except a true anti-Semite, is against Israel. We're not against Israel. I'm not against Israel. I'm very much for the Israeli people. I'm for the state of Israel, and I'm for its long-term genuine security. I think Chuck Hagel is the same way. We are not for, necessarily, Avigdor Lieberman, Bibi Netanyahu, and that cast of characters arranged around them, who have created a situation now where one out of five Israeli citizens is a settler, where the ultra-Orthodox groups in Israel who do not serve, by the way, sort of like Dick Cheney in this country, are so influential that they're now driving Israeli policy. And it's a very short-sighted policy. It's not aimed at a two-state solution and peace. It's aimed at occupying territory, eventually turning that territory over to Israeli territory and over to Israeli citizens. Look at the settlements. That's all you have to do to know that. So we're not against Israel. We're not against the future security of Israel. We're very much for it. But we're against this stupid government that's in power right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. So when you talk about Israel's long-term security, Colonel Wilkerson, I must say that I have a lot of friends in Israel, and I'm deeply concerned for Israel's future. It has gotten so dramatically worse recently, particularly with the ascendance of these right-wing governments. And the diaspora, as you point out, that most Jewish Americans, about up to 70%, voted Democrat and tend to be liberal, as opposed to AIPAC, the lobby that speaks for them, that's very, very right-wing and dominated by the Sheldon Adelsons and the big money people that give their money to Mitt Romney, who's a friend of Bibi Netanyahu's, and there's no question that Netanyahu tipped his hand in the last election, and it certainly appeared to be interfering. But if you just look at the neighborhood, the Sinai now is completely porous and chaotic and ungovernable. And then you've got Syria about to probably turn much more hostile to Israel with the Muslim Brotherhood government, as is the government now in Egypt. King Hussein is barely holding on in next door in Jordan, with whom Israel has a peace treaty, and he's 65% of the population there are Palestinian. They're under tremendous pressure from refugees from Iraq, from Cheney's folly in Iraq, and also refugees from the Syrian war. This whole area is a tinderbox. So for all those decades when Israel was immensely powerful, and it is still a military superpower, a lot of people would say, you know, that they're surrounded by people who want to kill them, and it was all hyperbole back in those days. But it's less and less hyperbole today. They are surrounded by a lot of people who want to kill them.
Well, they are surrounded by a lot of people who want to kill them, and they're surrounded increasingly by the world. If you look at the vote, for example, on the U.S. blockade of Cuba, our so-called embargo, 186-2 last year, and I think 187-3 this year, with Israel being in both years one of the few substantial countries that votes with us. This is the kind of isolation that we are getting into vis-a-vis Latin America because of Cuba, and it's the kind of isolation far more dangerous that Israel's getting into because of its policies. Israel has turned itself from the 1948 founding, where it was basically a socialist state, into an ultra-predatory capitalist state, where 12 or 13 families own 70% of the wealth. The security complex owns 51% of the land. Yes, 51% of the land. And Israel is dominated by a plutocracy, not unlike the way we're becoming dominated. And this has turned Israel on its head. It's destroyed its labor movement. It's destroyed its egalitarian policy. It certainly is no socialist state anymore, not by the stretch of the imagination. Israel has transformed itself into a garrison state run by a wealthy elite, and at the same time isolated itself not just in the Mediterranean but in the world. You're right. Israel is a deeply, deeply threatened country right now. And the situation around it, as you've described, with Morsi in Egypt, with King Hussein about looking like he's about to lose it in Jordan, with Assad already having lost it in Syria and no one knowing what the results are going to be, with Hamas able to win elections more than anyone else, with Hezbollah poised on the other border, Israel is in deep, deep trouble. And her IDF, as good as it might be, is not the kind of counter for the threat that they present now. They're the same kind of threat we're facing now all around Israel. The threat is Hezbollah. The threat is terrorism. The threat is asymmetrical. It's not the kind of threat you can roll tanks out and defeat. Look at us in Iraq. Look at us in Afghanistan. That's what Israel is confronting. So it needs desperately to come to terms with the threats around it and to develop some kind of peace plan that's feasible, workable, and comes to fruition and creates a Palestinian state living side by side with it in peace. Indeed, it needs that, if for no other reason, to get rid of the isolation that's created around itself, so it'll have some friends again other than the United States. Let me just hasten to add that one morning we're going to wake up in this country, and this is a great This is a profound fear of mine. We're going to wake up in this country, and suddenly the majority of the American people are going to say, why the hell are we even connected to with that little pipsqueak in the eastern end of the Mediterranean that causes us so much problems? And that's going to be the end of Israel's security. And we don't need to have that happen, but we're going to have it happen if we don't change policies and we don't change actors and we don't start looking at the world through a different set of lenses, a set of lenses that says peace in the eastern Mediterranean is the best thing, and the way to start that is with a settlement to the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
And it's worth noting, Colonel Wilkerson, that already Europe has turned against Israel. They were staunch defenders in the beginning, particularly France. And in many ways, I think it's the diaspora, the right-wing diaspora that supports AIPAC, that have also pushed Israel to the right, along with the immigrants from the former Soviet Union. Recently, Ehud Olmert, the former Likud prime minister, castigated an American audience of AIPAC by saying, you people are really quick to want to have us all die, for yep. your wars,
Yep.
I mean, there is that factor, I think, at play here.
There is, and your point about the Russian immigrants is a good one. Not all of them, of course, but many of them are the sort of people like Avigdor Lieberman, for example, who have come out of 70 years of a society that didn't know the daylight. And I don't know whether it's the security aspect of that, the threat aspect of that, the life-threatening aspect of that, that they are reacting the way they are in Israel, or if it's just the fact that they've come out of a state that was purely authoritarian and they want to turn Israel into such a state. I don't know what it is, but I can tell you that their influence, by and large, is not good.
So we don't know whether the president's going to, one, announce Hegel's candidacy, or two, stick by him. I guess that's the situation, just because I wanted to get on to Kerry in the last few minutes. What's your reading on that, Colonel Wilkerson?
I think John Kerry will make a good Secretary of State. I have the same problem with him, if you will, that I would have had Richard Lugar been made Secretary of State, having dealt with both Dick Lugar and John Kerry in their positions on the SFRC when I was Chief of Staff to Secretary Powell, and Secretary Powell was essentially dealing with Joe Biden as much as he was dealing with anyone else, because Joe Biden was one of the few characters on the SFRC from whom we could get an honest answer and who we knew, whenever we talked to him, knew what he was talking about. I have the same problem with Dick and John. It just is that they seem to have lost their spines. They seem to have lost their moral courage. They don't ever want to take a position that's against the conventional wisdom. They sometimes will do it in private. They sometimes will will hint at it in public, like, for example, on the Cuban embargo, which is the stupidest policy on the face of the earth, or like, for example, the hard-line policy we've taken towards Iran, where sanctions equals our diplomacy. We say we're for diplomacy, but all diplomacy is sanctions, ever-tightening sanctions, ever-crippling sanctions, as Secretary Clinton has said. So if they're not the kind of people who are going to stand up to some of this baloney and be counted, then I don't think they're going to be any better than anyone we've had in the past. And that's my biggest concern with John Kerry, that he has a spine, that he has moral courage, and that he takes some positions that are, let's say, not conventional wisdom, particularly with regard to Iran and Cuba.
Well, Senator, I suddenly was promoting you to Senator. Well, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Please don't.
I thank you so much for joining us, Colonel Wilkerson, and I hope you have a very happy Christmas.
You too, and take care.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army Colonel and former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking further about these nominations and also about the bombshell story that Bob Woodward uncovered that the press are ignoring. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And I guess there's no way to get any real sense of where Senator Chuck Hagel's nomination stands. It hasn't really been announced, but the AIPAC lobby and the neoconservatives are working overtime to scuttle it. But on the other hand, Senator Kerry's going to fly through. Of course, there's some mischief there on the part of the Republicans because his seat then becomes open in Massachusetts and they have a chance of picking it up in 2014. Do you know do you have any idea of what's going to happen with Hagel? Do you think the president's going to announce him and stand up for him?
I think he will, Ian. I think the defeat, as it were, over Ambassador Rice still rankles in the White House from everything that I hear, and I think he's pretty determined to go ahead with Hagel, thinking that he can he really can outflank the Israel lobby at this point. But this is a hard prediction to make because this White House can change on a dime, as you know, and if the pressure mounts in the right places at the right time, he could abandon Hagel as well.
So, and touching on Kerry, what about the idea of McCain and Lindsey Graham, who have really been made his life as difficult as possible for Obama at every turn? It almost feels like McCain is embittered by his defeat and has just can't get over it. And he sabotages anything that Obama does at every turn. But in this case, he's all in favor of Kerry. And I wonder whether there's an ulterior motive.
Well, Kerry is obviously the establishment candidate in that sense. And I think particularly after they got rid of Rice, and incidentally, I think from a progressive point of view that they may have done the left a favor in doing that. Her record was less than sterling. But in any event, Kerry is a fairly safe and sound appointment from their point of view. There really are, as you know, Ian, two John Kerry's. There's the early John Kerry, whose initial record in the Senate, and he was elected in 1984, his initial record all those years on the Foreign Relations Committee was really quite hopeful. He's was a leading light in the Iran-Contra hearings. He was at the forefront of exposing BCCI and the Panama machinations and so on. Now, of course, as Larry pointed out in your earlier segment, he has become very much the quintessential establishment figure and covering his rear at every turn. He's acceptable now to a good many Republicans as well as the Democratic Party. So one can only hope that John Kerry at some point may reemerge and reassert himself. But I see no real chance of that in the short run. He's very much, as Larry pointed out, on the wrong conventional side of all of these issues, from Iran to all of the issues pending for this administration in terms of the environment, climate change, the global economic crisis, which is still very much with us, the fundamental root foreign policy issues, which Hillary Clinton has done, a marvelous job of ignoring for the past 4 years, are still very much with us and unresolved.
So Roger Morris again served on senior staff of the National Security Council under both presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of the forthcoming book Between the Graves about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia. And we're talking about the nominations of expected nomination of Chuck Hagel to be Secretary of Defense, which the AIPAC lobby are trying to scuttle, and the nomination of John Kerry to become Secretary of State, which of course will go breezing through the Senate. You know, Roger, I've known Kerry, and I actually did organize the first fundraiser for him when he ran for president, way before he announced, back before he took the critical vote on the Iraq war resolution. And it was a real interesting experience. You know, this is one of the reasons why I really detest the way our politics run, because it's all about money. And this was all about money. It was about raising enough money to scare off the other candidates. So money was being used by tapping into the Hollywood money, because we had a bunch of movie stars and others. You know, everybody paid $1,000 a head. And I had to organize it all. And I just ended up thinking what a dreadful experience the whole thing was. And of course, that was before the floodgates were opened by the Supreme Court with the Citizens United decision. But anyway, the long and the short of it was that at that time, in this really lovely setting in California, most of the people that had paid their thousands of dollars to meet this prospective presidential candidate really lit into him on the Iraq war and saying, don't vote, don't vote. He heard it so loud and clear, and yet he did vote. And his rationale for voting for that bogus war resolution, against the advice of the Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by Bob Graham, who forced the NIE in the first place. The White House didn't, Bush White House didn't even want an NIE. They were so cocky about going to war. And everybody on the Intelligence Committee, except Feinstein, voted against the resolution because they knew it was phony. There were no WMD, no evidence. Yet Kerry and Senator Clinton all voted for it. And Kerry's rationale was, if I don't vote for this, I'll never get a vote in the South. Well, guess what? He didn't get a vote in the South anyway.
That's right. You know, I think your anecdote is very well taken. He's one of the classic victims of the utter corruption of this money tyranny that we have in American politics. Even quite a wealthy man like Kerry, who comes, of course, of a somewhat aristocratic background and married wealth, has enjoyed wealth all his life, not immune from the necessity of accumulating this mass fortune that's necessary for running for office. I remember John Kerry, Ian, very well, that beautiful day in 1971 when he first appeared on the national scene, testifying before the Foreign Relations Committee on the war in Vietnam, made his memorable statements about not being the last man to die for a mistake. He was accompanied, of course, by a small ragtag army of Vietnam War veterans, many of whom were grievously wounded and highly decorated, who all threw their medals and decorations over the fence, as you may remember, there on Capitol Hill. That was the early John Kerry I spoke about a minute ago, and he remained somewhat true to those principles as a young lieutenant governor of Massachusetts under Mike Dukakis, and then when he first ran for the Senate, a rather distinguished record. If you go back and look at some of the committee reports that Kerry authored as a young senator on corruption and the drug trade, on the compromise of the CIA, and particularly a policy in Central and Latin America, it's all very, for its time, avant-garde. But he does, of course, slowly adapt and slowly surrender to what's called in Washington the encirclement. And by the time he becomes a contender for national office, which I think was always his ambition, almost from the very beginning, by the time he's contending for the presidency, he's utterly compromised. Now, one can only hope, this is the twilight appointment of his career, one can only hope that this is a moment when he may find the courage and the independence to stand up. He's not going to be running for office again. I don't think he has any pretense to the presidency beyond the second Obama administration. And I think this is the moment for the real John Kerry, the early John Kerry, to emerge. But that may be something of a pipe dream.
So, Roger Marsh, let's turn in the last few minutes then to the other story that I've been covering. I played the entire tape of the solicitation of General Petraeus by Fox News, their emissary, Katie McFarlane, their national security advisor, reporter, had gone to Kabul to meet with Petraeus, conveying the message from Roger Ailes that Roger Ailes wants Petraeus to run for president, excuse me, against Obama. They're not happy with the Republican field, with the feckless field that they had with Romney, etc. And that they promise him the world, you know, that Rupert Murdoch will bankroll it, Roger Ailes will take leave of absence to run the campaign. All you have to do is just sign on the dotted line. This tape ends up being revealed by Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, but it comes out on the style section. It's buried in the back. Nobody in the press has picked up on it. I did a piece about it when it came out, and then I did a piece last Sunday with the former CIA officer Bob Baer, who took the ball further by suggesting that actually the CIA it was an inside job. They got rid of Petraeus because he was dumped on them by Obama, who wanted to get him off the street and inside the tent before Fox News recruited him. So they put him at CIA. The CIA hated him, and they eventually found a way to get rid of him. So to me, this is an extraordinary story. I mean, and I just am dumbfounded. I mean, Carl Bernstein wrote a piece in the Guardian, basically saying the same. He said, "What happened? Why hasn't this been reported? Do you have any answers to why the press have been so silent?"
I, I have to say first that I think it's one of the most disgraceful episodes in American journalism in a very, very long while. This is a major story. It's eavesdropping on a veritable coup d'etat, given the kind of power that Murdoch exercises with his wealth and with his media empire and all the rest. This is constitutionally, it's interference from abroad, as it were, after all. Everything about it just smells to high heaven, and my own sense of why this has not been taken up is very much the same that Carl wrote about in The Guardian. I think there's fear and loathing, but a lot of fear of Fox and of that empire in the rest of the media. I think there is this ineradicable shallowness, which we face all the time. If it's not our story, if we didn't break it, somehow it's relatively unimportant. And, of course, the grand scandal here begins with the Washington Post, in which the managing editor had the utter absurd temerity to say this was not a major news story and only a media buzz story, which belonged in the style section. No, I think this is fascinating. I agree with Bob. I know that there was enormous discontent at the agency over the Petraeus appointment. There was an obvious feeling that he was being dumped and exiled there, and that they deserved better. They had served Obama fairly faithfully and well when the appointment was made. People in the agency, after all, knew what the media was not reporting, what the public largely did not know, which was that Petraeus was a papier-mâché figure, very largely a creature of his publicity agents, and was not the kind of director that the agency thought it deserved or wanted. Now, what the exact machinations were, we can only guess. There are so many unanswered questions. Another scandal by the media. Here we have the toppling of this supposedly major figure in American military and political life, and the Paula Broadwell story is pursued only so far. The Petraeus story is truncated. Yeah, I think this is one that historians will chew into and well, Ian, in years to come.
So, Roger Marsh, why then, do the rivals to Fox, why is the rest of the press complicitous in covering up Fox News' criminal behavior? And this, it's an outrage what Murdoch and Ailes tried to do.
They really haven't covered very well the scandal in Britain either. I do think there is this strange fraternity of corruption. I think in the media, of course. MSNBC is not an exact replica of Fox, but rather too close. The other networks, I think, fear the sheer potential that Fox has for hurting their markets, hurting their advertising, hurting their audience. We haven't seen any genuine civil war, after all this petty bickering between celebrity talk show hosts. Is not the kind of serious network civil war that you could have if Fox seriously went after mainstream coverage, with which there is much discontent, as you know, always in the body politic, particularly in the constituency, the right wing and sort of know nothing constituency that Fox panders to. So that I genuinely think that Carl was right about the fear factor in the media's reaction. But this is, again, one of those many stories that requires genuine digging, requires genuine cultivation of sources. I have no doubt that the agency was capable of and probably in the end disposed to do something like this. The Paula Broadwell story has just, in effect, vanished. I remember the very, very portentous comment by her father saying, well, there's a lot more to this than has come out. Now, of course, nothing more has indeed come out. So I just think, it, as I said, Ian, it's a major scandal. But we move in this age from scandal to scandal in terms of what the media is doing and not doing. And, of course, they are very complicitous in the failures that we ascribe largely to politics and to government, because government does indeed in the end respond to how it's covered.
But it should be manifestly clear, Roger Marsh, to everybody what a toxic debilitating effect that Rupert Murdoch has had on the press, just from the disgraceful scandals that come out of England. So we know what he's done to journalism, and yet the FCC are about to allow him to buy the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, it seems.
Well, it's the syndrome of what I would call this ugly worship of wealth and power in America. Until he really commits an overt crime somehow in America, which is not impossible, he will not only be tolerated, but his influence will be heeded and rewarded. As long as he has the capacity to hurt, to punish, in the political world, Washington will pay attention. Sure. And will pay deference.
Well, but he is also, I think, he's largely responsible for why our politics are so poisonous and so strident and so polarized.
Fox News has
really pushed the envelope in that regard. I thank you for joining us, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new forthcoming book is Between the Graves. It's about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the NRA. NRA's bizarre press conference. Tell me, who's that fool than you? Tell the truth. Who's that fool than you? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who is AltaNet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article at altanet.org, NRA's Bizarre Press Conference, More Guns Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And you described this press conference at the Willard Hotel that the NRA held at the end of last week after a week of silence since the shooting in the school in Newtown, Connecticut. So, I mean, I think most people, well, I guess we're in an alternative universe here. Progressives and liberals and centrists and reasonable people in this country are pretty appalled by what happened. But the NRA is out there on planet guns, and more guns.
That's right. It was just an astonishing event, Ian. I mean, I've got to say, you know, when you go to a press conference of, you know, on a topic of national import with people who are important players at the podium, you know, the whole of the mainstream media are there, right? You've got CNN and the Associated Press and, you know, the whole gamut, right? All the Washington bureaus of all the big papers, plus a lot of journalists from overseas, you know, representing overseas outlets. So it was a packed room. And mainstream media journalists are quite adept at not displaying emotion or, you know, in situ, right, when they're in the situation. Because
right. Well, they're trained to be the piano players in the whorehouse, right?
Well, you could put it that way.
Right.
And this the sense of incredulity that you saw in the room, like people actually turning around and looking to make eye contact with each other to say, is it me or is this really, really crazy? Because it was crazy from the get-go. I mean, first of all, they made a big show of making, of doing an elaborate sweep of the room, as if Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president of the National Rifle Association, was the president, and we all had to wait outside while they made their sweep outside the doors of the room, and then we get in there, and they've got this 4-foot-high barrier erected in front of the front row. And honestly, it was purely symbolic. I mean, it was probably made of like plastic pipes and was draped in blue velvet. And then set back from that about, I don't know, 15 feet or so was the podium. I mean, the guys who were shooting photographs in the front row had to use long lenses to shoot pictures of the from the very get-go, I guess that long setup is to say the whole event evinced the sort of paranoia that drives gun culture in America, and it just went on from there.
Well, wasn't the first thing that was stated was that there'd be no questions?
Yes, before they even began, they call it a press conference. And David Keene, the president of the NRA, who late of the American Conservative Union, he used to lead that, announces they will take no questions at this event. So he just introduced Wayne LaPierre, who delivered a speech, and then LaPierre introduced Asa Hutchinson to roll out their great new plan, what they called their meaningful contribution to the nation in the wake of this massacre, this murder of 20 children and 7 adults, which is to arm school personnel, and that they will, you know, provide training for free. Isn't that nice of them? So it's an opportunity to sell more guns.
Well, that's what their job is. They are the lobby for the gun manufacturers and the ammunition manufacturers. And, of course, the line that got the headlines and was played all over the media, so it wasn't a complete failure for LaPierre, because the line that they played was LaPierre saying the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Right. And you know what's so offensive about that, Ian? If you go to if you saw them, and many, many people did, ABC the day after the killings or perhaps the day of, interviewed a first grade teacher who survived, and she saved her kids, her students, by packing them all into a tiny little bathroom, and she recounted. You know, Diane Sawyer asked her what she, you know, how she talked to those kids, how she dealt with them while she was, how did she explain this? And the way she explained it, and this was widely seen all over America, was that there are bad guys out there right now, and we're going to stay here until the good guys come. So to me, to hear her language echoed and twisted and coming out of the mouth of Wayne LaPierre was just, I mean, it was shameless and it was heartless.
Again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article at alternet.org, NRA's Bizarre Press Conference, More Guns Now. Now, there was the protests, of course, were outside from Credo Action, and then inside, members of Code Pink held up signs saying NRA killing our kids, and Medea Benjamin of Code Pink held up a banner, NRA blood on your hands. They were both ejected fairly quickly. There were no questions. But what apparently happened there was that Wayne LaPierre blamed everybody but the NRA.
It was just astonishing. I mean, he went through the list because, I mean, first of all, you know, in the wake of such a tragedy, it is human nature for us to try to make sense out of it, right? And, you know, what could have been done differently? What was this about? And of course, in the week of silence we had from the NRA, people have been all over the media hashing this out, right? So, you know, guns, video games, you know, are our schools secure enough? You know, all sorts of, how do we deal with the mentally ill? All of these questions people have been discussing on op-ed pages and on television. So what Pierre did was just sort of compile them all and omit the guns part. So he blamed, did a big thing on video games, which, believe me, I think that the video games that our kids are, many of our kids are playing, are really problematic, and there is research to show that it does, insensitize people to violence. And but he showed a clip of one of them, of this cartoon video game called Kindergarten Killer. I swear, and showed the clip of one kid shooting another kid in the head and blood spurts out. He blamed Barack Obama, saying that Obama had cut grants for school security. He blamed Quentin Tarantino. He blamed Hollywood movies. He blamed the refusal of our nation to put together a database of mentally ill people. Now imagine that.
Well, but this is where it is absolutely outrageous, and because the press weren't able to ask questions, somebody should have shouted out from the press that you guys, the NRA, are the reason that data about the mentally ill and those who purchase guns are not shared. There's a thing called the Tyhard Amendment that was put through by the NRA that forbids law enforcement from sharing data on guns. You talk to any cop, any district attorney, almost every crime that they deal with is gun-related. Almost every crime.
Right.
And the courts are full of people being processed for murder, for felony murder, and for armed robbery. And the reason that we're alone amongst the civilized world in having this mayhem on our streets is entirely to do with the fact that the NRA have crippled the ATF, the government bureaus whose job it is to trace firearms. I've talked to ATF people. They say our hands are tied.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that amendment, and I do shudder to think of what kind of database Wayne LaPierre is talking about. Would anybody who ever, saw a therapist be in his idea of a database, right? And you're quite right, though, about, the gun show loophole, which is just absurd, where you have to run a background check on somebody purchasing an arm at Walmart, but they can go to one of these gun shows, which any weekend in America you can find a large one happening, and purchase with no background check whatsoever. You can be a criminal and buy an assault rifle, just like the one that Adam Lanza used.
Right off the back of a truck. Mm-hmm. Now, the proposal, though, following LaPierre, where the former Congressman Hutchison talked about this new plan that they've got to arm security guards at schools.
Right.
He apparently went to great pains to assure the Tea Party followers, who, of course, make up that coalition of market fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, and gun toters.
Right.
So he said, basically, it's going to operate on a volunteer basis.
Right.
Does that mean that we're going to have a bunch of George Zimmermans from the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida?
That's a good point. That's a good point, Ian. Yes, it does.
I mean, that's what happens when you have vigilante volunteers or all these wannabe cops like George Zimmerman, who are, incredibly dangerous people. They're going to be showing up at schools armed and looking for somebody to shoot.
That's right. That's right. People with a grudge, people who believe that anybody who doesn't look like them is a suspicious character. It's just a recipe for disaster. Just baldly exploitive of such a horrible tragedy. The comic Elon James White tweeted after the press conference, and now we know why the NRA generally stays silent during mass killings, after mass killings, because it was just such a horrid, horrid display. But you are quite right in that, saying that this may have really worked for LaPierre, because indeed, yes, the genius framing of that one quote about good guys and bad guys. And, we have to remember who his audience is. His audience is not regular Americans. It's not even the membership of the NRA, many of whom approve of some sort of tightened gun control. you know, it is, as we said, the gun manufacturers. If you go to the NRA site, you see all these different features sponsored by different gun manufacturers. There's like a video presentation, I think it's called like the Women's Hour, that's sponsored by Smith & Wesson. I'm not kidding. I mean, this is just who they are, and it's and they are so, so very strong.
Well, just in closing, Adele Stan, they are strong, and they're a powerful lobby, and they intimidate the Congress. That's a given. And the Democrats in particular are cowering.
Right.
And guns have never been discussed by the Obama administration in all the time that they've been in office until now for that reason. However, if you go to the NRA's website, guess what their membership is? That they say on their own site what their membership is.
I have not looked that up.
Well, it's 4.3 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that, with a population of over 300 million, they are the 1%.
Right.
So what in the hell are they talking about? Why are the Congress so afraid of these people? You know, their bark is so much worse than their bite.
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely correct. But I think the fear is not from their membership, Ian. It's from the dollars they wield through their PAC and through the fear of the primary challenge, which, of course, is the coin of the realm in the Tea Party, right? If your congressman doesn't vote the way you want, you challenge him in a primary the next time up. And they can do that. They can make that kind of mischief with Democrats too in more rural areas. So I think that the fear is much more of the NRA leadership than it is of its membership, because even those members, I mean, a significant portion of them are for a majority of them are for closing the gun show loophole and for other forms of gun control.
Well, I just want to quote your article here at the end of your article at Alternet, Adele Stan, NRA's bizarre press conference, More Guns Now. You quote Becky Bond, the political director of Credo, which is the group that were protesting. She said, if teachers could stand up to a gunman with a semi-automatic assault weapon, then Congress can stand up to the NRA and its lobbyists. You know, we can only hope, but I mean, it's pretty pathetic that the only way to stop them is for a rich guy like Mayor Bloomberg to dip into his pockets and give wavering congressmen the money that they need to counter the money that the arms and ammunition manufacturers are funneling through the NRA to have them defeated.
Yeah, that's astonishing that that's the way it has to go. And of course, you know, Bloomberg is not a beloved figure on the left. His relationship to things like the First Amendment are a little shaky. But that is where we are. That's exactly where we are.
Well, Adele Stan, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article at alternet.org, NRA's Bizarre Press Conference, More Guns Now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. An angel sung about the home of the brave and this land here under the free, one time, one night.